Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. They have beautiful C41 color neg, black and white, color chrome, and of course, instant. Instant film rocks. These guys have so much great things going on right now with instant film. Of course, they have the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4 by 5. Color, black and white, high speed black and white. But you know what's even cooler? They have the Instax cameras and film. The Instax Wide is in the country, available everywhere. And of course, right now, brand new, the Instax Mini is now in the U.S. They have cameras. They have film. This Instax Mini is 2.5 by 3.5. It's the size of a business card. This is really fun stuff. You got to check it out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film to get developed, proofs, you name it. They got a great workflow going. www.richardphotolab.com. DR5 for the most unbelievable proprietary process to turn your black and white film into positives, into chrome. You won't believe until you get your film back as a piece of chrome will blow your mind. The dynamic range, the latitude, it's just unbelievable stuff. Definitely check it out. www.dr5.com. Iger Studios, Lenny Iger, the place to have high-resolution scans done. You know, a lot of people now are shooting analog. They're using a high-resolution scan. They're making digital negatives on an inkjet, or maybe they're going straight to an inkjet output, but they're making digital negatives and they're printing contact prints. They're doing all the stuff you need to get a high-resolution scan. They're using an Aztec Premier, 8,000 PPI, adjustable aperture. They can give you scans that are basically grain-free. They can adjust it for every kind of film out there. This is crazy stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. Check them out, igerstudios.com. And of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. The camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group. The place on the web for all things analog process. This is a great place to learn, to share information, to get tips and tricks. The community for analog photography, www.apug.org. And of course, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org. The place to go to find out about the history of traditional analog photography. These people are keeping this alive. They have over 7,000 cameras in their museum of everything that's ever been made, including the Hasselblads that were shot on the moon. You name it. They have the collection. This is a great way to help support. You can be a member of George Eastman House organization. They have a lot of great things going on, but this is something you can do to help give back to photography, to help keep traditional analog photography alive for generations to come. Definitely check them out, www.geh.org. On Inside Analog Photography, today we're going to have with us Alan Chin. Alan is a professional photojournalist, documentary photographer traveling the world, and of course, shooting film. Alan's got a lot of beautiful work, a lot of great stories, and he's a really cool guy. Alan, how you doing today?
Very good. Beautiful autumn day in Beijing, China.
It is a great day, and thank you so much here for joining us on Inside Analog Photo. Great to feature you this week. Alan, you're a professional photojournalist, documentary photographer. You're doing a lot of cool stuff. Right now, of course, you're in Beijing. So to start with, tell us about Alan. What do you do? What have you been doing? What's your normal gig right now?
Well, as sure know, we have many of the news magazines dying and newspapers contracting. For most of the last 15 years, I have worked for many of the major publications, the New York Times, Newsweek magazine, and then through the various agencies which have distributed my work to all kinds of other magazines and newspapers. I want to say that I'm here in Beijing in part because it is the 20th anniversary of Tiananmen Square in 1989. And 20 years ago, actually, in a way, how my career began, I took the first pictures I ever published and sold during the brutal government crackdown on the student protesters here 20 years ago. And so I'm back this year, in part to kind of mark that personal anniversary, but in part also to continue my ongoing kind of project covering China.
So let's go back to the beginnings when Alan started shooting. Did you get into photography when you were a kid? What brought you around to want to shoot pictures?
My father was a very avid amateur photographer. He had very beautiful equipment. He had Leica and Nikon cameras, which I learned photography on as a teenager. I am Chinese-American. I was born in the United States, but my family is all from China. And I was in China on my first trip to discover one's ethnic roots, that kind of thing. And it turned out to be 1989, and it was the year of the pro-democracy student movement in Beijing at that time, as you know. And so I found myself, as a young boy, really, with a camera, taking pictures. Of course, horrifically, it turned into a massacre and a crackdown. I ended up selling those pictures to the Reuters news agency, so I saw my work published and was paid for the very first time. I never really looked back from that moment.
So tell me, Alan, about the work you're doing now in Beijing, the anniversary of Tiananmen Square. That was back in June now. You're still in Beijing, so what are you working on now?
I'm working on several different things. The anniversary, of course, turned out not to be a particularly momentous occasion, because the government here continues to be quite repressive when it comes to discussing the anniversary of Tiananmen Square. But China is a very tumultuous place in all ways. We did have in July a rather large outbreak of ethnic violence between the Uyghurs, which are a minority people, and the majority Han Chinese group. More than 200 people were killed out in Xinjiang province. I ended up being on assignment and covering that story for Newsweek magazine and also for the New York Times. And last year when I was here, again, there was a horrific earthquake in Sichuan province that killed tens of thousands of people. And again, I found myself rushing to cover it. Of course, neither of these outbreaks of tragedy were planned, but being a photojournalist, I rushed as quickly as I could. When I'm not doing that, my ancestral village is here in South China, so I have been spending a lot of time there. As I said, I was born in the United States, but everyone before me had been born in this one very small village. It's a very interesting rural agricultural community, and I plan to spend some time there over the next year or two on a kind of longer-term personal documentation of life in my ancestral village.
Wow, very, very cool. So how have you seen the changes there in China from when you originally were there in mid to late 80s to what you see now? You're going around the country taking documentary photography. You're doing photojournalistic work. Do you have issues? I mean, the government lets you do whatever you want. It's all free and cool.
To be fair, it's not all free and cool, even in democratic countries like Western Europe. Always are controls and rules and regulations and things. But to be fair to the Chinese, it is for someone like me who is ethnically Chinese and I don't look different from most people on the street, it's fairly easy for me to work. I can move around very freely and cheaply. Certainly when I'm working on a personal project, such as I have been in my village, no one bothers me. My family is known to be from there. In that sense, I have a certain kind of, not privilege, but certainly access, which I take advantage of. And I do speak Cantonese, so I'm able to talk to people very freely. And in general, the changes of the last 20 years, and particularly even the last 5 or 10 years, have been enormous. The economic powerhouse that China is no surprise to anyone. What that's meant is that for the first time in China's history, you have a growing middle class. People are beginning to buy and own their own cars. They're beginning to buy modern apartments and modern houses that don't look or feel much different from places in the West. You have also a much larger group that's in the working class, which is still struggling and has a tough life, but they are able to find jobs, even if not very good, well-paid ones. And so you do have a pretty low level of unemployment, at least compared to other places. And so you have a society that's very much in transition. The number of people getting on the internet every day is growing. The number of people travel is growing. And so you see that. And in some ways, certainly in a big city like Beijing, some neighborhoods, it doesn't feel very different from London or Paris or New York. Clearly, if you go 50 or 100 miles or even down the street around the corner into a more working class neighborhood, it still feels very much like traditional China.
Do you find that with these new Western things that have been growing in China with the more availability with money and the internet and stuff, do you see any difference in the people from when you originally visited China and what's going on with their attitude, maybe with the government and the way things are? I guess the point is people from the West think of China as this lockdown communist people are all enslaved and it's crazy stuff going on. And I guess the point is, it's probably not much difference when you're running around Beijing than it would be if you're in Manhattan.
I think that that works on two levels. On the one level, it is true. This is still a one-party state where there are no elections. There is no independent judiciary, and it lacks all those things. Human rights, of course, is a problem that comes up constantly here in many, many different ways. But I want to make a distinction between political life and public life, which is what we're talking about, and private life. Basically, the government in the last 20 years has made a kind of deal with the population, which is that we will continue to have a monopoly on state power and on public power, but we, as part of this reform and economic reform, we are giving up our control over people's personal lives, where you live, what kind of job you have, who you sleep with. These things, the government is much less intrusive than it once was. Not perhaps to the level of the West, again, but certainly compared to what it was before. That change is real and significant. Because, of course, for the majority of people, politics is something they may think about when it affects them, but most of the time they care more about their families and their jobs and all the ordinary struggles of life. So you have a very parallel thing or double-sided thing going on with that, where in some ways it remains a police state, but in other ways there is a level of personal freedom that, while not equal to that in the West, is certainly much more than it once was.
When you're out shooting, you are very much a film advocate. You shoot a lot of black and white. When you're actually out on assignment, you're shooting this stuff. How do you capture these images on film and get them back to these magazines and newspapers that you're doing work for? Tell me how you work, because I know there's been some great stories about the way you'll soup stuff in a hotel room or a car or whatever it takes to get the stuff done. How do you get this imagery back to the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, whoever you're shooting for?
Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about that. I do, depending on how much baggage I'm able to carry, whether I'm able to have my own car or if I'm flying, obviously sometimes you bring more kit than others. But perhaps if I have my own car or at least access to one and baggage is not particularly a concern, I am a little bit of a gearhead. I'll be the first to admit that. And I travel with both film and digital cameras. When you are on assignment, sometimes the deadlines are very pressing and I do shoot digital. Certainly, I think for color photography, this new generation of digital cameras is very good, much better than they were even just a couple of years ago. However, I want to add that for black and white, which is the majority of my work, I think that although you can do things in Photoshop and you can do all kinds of things, there's nothing that really replaces black and white film when you want to capture a black and white image. It's just something about the real silver grain quality of that. So typically, I'll travel with two film cameras and one digital camera. Also, I will travel with a medium format film camera and sometimes also a panoramic film camera. So sometimes I might be carrying in my bag five or six cameras. And in addition, I'll bring at least one computer, sometimes two, because there's nothing worse than having your computer crash on you when you're in the middle of nowhere. And if I don't think that there's any access to a lab, I will bring my film development chemistry kit, which fits actually surprisingly into a small bag the size of a six-pack or a couple of books, not very big. And in that, I can bring two developing tanks. Each one can develop four rolls of film, so I can develop eight rolls of film at a time. And of course, when you bring your chemistry in its powdered or its concentrate form, it doesn't take up a lot of space. I don't actually mix my chemicals till I get to where I'm going, and then I just get some plastic rainwater bottles or things like that. I'm able to mix my chemicals only when I get to where I'm going. So when I'm traveling, that whole kit actually only weighs a couple pounds and it's into a corner of my backpack. I also do travel sometimes with a film scanner, a Nikon 35mm film scanner, which allows me to make high-resolution scans after I develop my film. And to tell you the truth, it's really not that much slower than working digitally. And I know people laugh at me when I say this, but I'll tell you why. Typically, when you shoot digitally, you'll shoot a job, an assignment, or whatever it might be. You'll shoot hundreds or even 1,000 images in a day sometimes, as you know. And then you have to go back to your hotel room or wherever you might be staying, and you have to download your memory cards, and you have to look at everything on Photoshop. Then you still have to Photoshop your images and get them the way you want them to look before you transmit them over the internet. So if you're shooting film, if you say shoot five or eight rolls of film, I come home, I spend an hour processing it, I have 8 rolls of film. I look at them. I trade 5 or 10 or 15 images that I think are the best ones. I spend 3 or 4 minutes scanning each of them on my scanner. Ultimately, this might take an hour longer than if I shot digitally, but not much more than that. At the end of the night, I'm able to hit that send button, and those pictures go through the internet just as the digital pictures would have in a high-resolution form. So then when they land on my editor's desk in New York or Paris or wherever, for them, it's no different in the field how we capture the pictures. We could shoot them digitally. We can shoot them on film. People use Polaroids. People use Hogas. It doesn't really matter as long as we're getting aesthetically and graphically the pictures that we want to get. So that's my working method. It does seem a little bit antiquated to a lot of people, but I'd like to remind people that before the digital age, this is what all of us did. You traveled with chemistry, or you had to find a one-hour lab in the days when we were shooting color negative, and we went through this entire process in the same way. So in some ways, since the advent of modems and laptop computers in the late 80s and the early 90s, nothing's really changed that much for me, regardless of which camera I take the picture with.
So let's talk about when you are out shooting in the field. So let's say you're shooting an assignment for XYZ magazine. It doesn't matter. Do you actually have editors say, Alan, can you shoot that on film because I just really want that look for this story? Or they don't care how they get it as long as they get it?
I think it really depends on the assignment. If it's a breaking news story, obviously I don't think they care very much how they get it. I think what they're looking for is the immediacy of breaking news. If it's like some of the stories I've covered, whether you're in a war zone or it's a horrific natural disaster or it's a political event, they, of course, they want beautiful, good pictures, but they don't really care how you do it, and it's really up to you. On other assignments, if it's a feature story where you have more time to spend on something, if you're in the field, I have had editors tell me how much they love the look of the black and white film that I shoot, and they will ask me to shoot that. And of course, I'm very happy to comply. It's what I love most, and we're all happy when that is the case. There have been other times when, in the old days, people would load a camera with color film and another camera with black and white film, because they had to serve many masters at once. And so me, sometimes I'll shoot both with a digital camera for color and a black and white camera with film, and I'll be able to send both kinds of images. But more than one occasion where they were simply expecting a kind of standard color digital result, and when I was able to provide them with the option to have black and white very well, they were thrilled because it gave them more choices and it gave them more control over the kind of images they could publish. So I've had editors who've been very happy that I've shot film.
Let's talk about that. What kind of film are you shooting? What do you like to shoot?
The basic film I shoot is your standard black and white ASA 400 speed film, which is the standard Kodak Tri-X or the Ilford HP5 or the Fuji Neopan 400. These are all relatively similar films. And in fact, I've even developed them all together in the same tank with the same chemistry at the same time and temperature, because they're really quite similar, and unless you're really a technical expert, it's very hard to tell the difference. I find that they are the standard general feed black and white films. I think they're very, very useful for daylight, and even in artificial light indoors or at night, you can push these films, or you can simply hold your breath maybe and use a longer shutter speed, and the results tend to be, in my mind, what I like to think of as a very classic standard black and white look. The kind of look that was once popularized by Life magazine or the classic photographers Walker Evans or Robert Frank or people like that who were very influential on me when I was learning photography.
So out of the three, I mean, you don't care. As long as you can get one of these emulsions, you're happy. I mean, is there one that's just like Alan's going to hork and freeze as much as he can get a hold of? I mean, is there any film that you just really love more than anything over the top?
No, as I said, I think they're basically each big company's version of the same thing with very, very, very minor differences. And so frankly, when I go to B&H in New York, the big photo superstore, whichever one happens to be cheapest at the moment is the one that I tend to buy 40, 50, 60 rolls of at a time. And I'm very happy just to shoot that batch. And then the next time I go to the store, if there's a sale or a discount on one of the other brands, I'll be happy to buy that one. And I've had exhibitions where the images from the different kinds of film are shown side by side, and you cannot tell that they are shot on different films. They are basically the same film.
Very, very cool. So let's talk about gear. So what do you like to shoot with? You shooting all Leica with your film cameras?
My friends and colleagues who know me tease me sometimes because it is true that most working photographers like myself are not really collectors. And it's a little bit eccentric to be a working photographer and to also have a real love of the machines, which I have to admit that I do. So my main cameras are like 35mm rangefinder cameras, which I've used since I was 16 years old. But also sometimes, especially with a wider lens or a longer lens, where the rangefinder doesn't show the perspective so well, I do use both Nikon and Canon SLR cameras, the standard ones. And then, as I mentioned before, for the medium format, I have a Rolleiflex twin lens camera made in the 1960s that I absolutely love. It's one of the smallest medium format cameras of that level of high quality that you can get. And so it doesn't take up a lot more room in my bag, and it allows me to shoot a square 6x6 image. And then sometimes also I like to bring along a Wideluxe panoramic camera. It's a rotating lens camera. This makes a very long panoramic image, which for certain situations is also a wonderful additional trick to have in your bag. And for lenses, my main lens for the 35mm is a 28mm lens, which is a moderately wide-angle lens. But I find that the 28mm is really my favorite lens. It allows you to work comfortably when you're photographing people a distance of about 4 to 8 feet, which is a very comfortable distance if you're also having a conversation with that person. It allows you to be close enough to see them, but yet, because it is a wide-angle lens, it allows you to see a little bit of their surroundings as well. It's not just a tight portrait of somebody, but it also offers the context of the place that you happen to be in. And so I love the 28mm lens, regardless of which camera I might be using.
How have you seen the photographic environment there in Beijing where you're at? Are they still shooting film? Is it all digital? What have you noticed that the general population, is anybody taking pictures? I know that everybody thinks, well, oh, they're in China. They must be shooting Panax or some old stuff. I mean, I guess other photographers would wonder, how is the photographic environment as a photographer in China? I mean, is there some cool stores you get to go around and look at gear? Are you finding cool stuff that you can't find anywhere? Well, how's that working?
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about that. Most large Chinese cities, certainly Beijing here, which is the capital, and also Guangzhou in the south, which are the two that I'm most familiar with, these camera markets, it's great. It's a photographic shopping mall. The one in Guangzhou is actually bigger than the one here in Beijing, but even the one here in Beijing has about 20 or 30 different shops all in the same building. It's kind of like a shopping mall of photography, and it runs the gamut. There are shops that specialize in more antique and vintage film cameras. There are shops that are the authorized dealers for the newest Nikon or Canon or Fuji equipment, all the major brands, Olympus and Sony. There are shops that specialize in printers and ink for people who are printing digitally. There are shops that specialize in darkroom chemistry for the people that do continue to print their own black and white. I want to add that wedding photography is a huge industry in China, even bigger than it is in the United States. It's a huge industry everywhere, of course, since people do tend to get married at some point in life, or most people do. And when you get married, you need pictures and you want to hire a professional photographer. And in China, which is a huge country with a huge population that is, of course, getting married at some point. So the wedding photography industry here is enormous. And these camera markets, there's a whole section of them where they sell wedding albums and where they sell a lot of studio lights and studio backdrops because people have these wedding studios. There will be stores where they sell camera bags and tripods. It's quite fabulous. And as everyone knows, there is piracy in China where copyright sometimes is not enforced very well. And so some Chinese manufacturers sometimes will take like a donkey or a camera bag that sells for $100 in the United States and they'll make a reasonably high quality copy of it and they'll sell it for a third or a half or even a quarter of the price here in China. And so you can get some things very, very cheaply here that are of reasonably high quality. And in some cases, it's even the same factory where they're actually producing the item for the international market, but maybe they produced a few more, or maybe there's some kind of corrupt arrangement, or maybe someone's looking the other way, and it's a way to sell some of the stuff cheaply. I mean, in the U.S., we have the gray market, which is in some ways similar, and here you could even say it's almost a black market. So when you go to the camera mall, you see a lot of these things. And so you can get anything you want here, pretty much.
Wow, how fun. It sounds like a trip to Beijing would be worth it just to go looking for gear.
Well, traditionally, of course, people would go to Hong Kong for that, which was very famous over the years for that. Yes, you can still do that in Hong Kong and throughout Asia, in China and Japan and Hong Kong. Photography is, I think you could say, amongst the middle class, at least, it's perhaps a bigger hobby than it is in the United States. Of course, it's a huge hobby in the United States, and many people love photography. But in China, I would argue that it may even be slightly bigger here. Because, again, like I said, with things like weddings and also with the strong emphasis on family in Asian society, it's very common for dad to want to photograph the life of the family. And so you see a lot of people in the middle class that we were talking about who are willing to spend a fair amount of money on photography. So there's a real love of photography in that sense. I do, however, want to contrast that with the professional market here, which, of course, in many ways is less developed than it is in the United States or Europe, because, of course, historically, there was no such thing as a freelance professional photographer. If you worked for the newspaper, of course, you worked as a staff employee. The idea to be an independent small contractor, small businessman in China is still, of course, relatively new. And so to be a kind of independent freelance photographer is still quite difficult here, because the culture is not accustomed for clients to hire freelancers to do these things. So oftentimes, if I were to live here full-time, or if I were Chinese and trying to make it, I think in some ways it would be much more difficult than it is in the West, even though in other ways it might be easier as well.
So really, I guess with the professional photography, and like you said, with the wedding and portrait stuff going on there in China, really you don't have these superstar American-type photographers that people are paying these huge monies for. I guess it's more of a studio becomes the name, and it's really not geared towards the said person. It's really more towards the entity.
There's perhaps an aspect of that, but there are, of course, some Chinese photographers that have become very prominent, both domestically here and internationally. But like I said, in a general sense, I think there is truth to what you just said, because, yes, a lot of companies will keep these things in-house, for example. They'll have a staff photographer rather than hire a freelancer to do it. And so when something like that happens, of course, it's a lot tougher for the independent guy to break in.
Very interesting. And you find that because of the acquisition cost? Because I think if you find a Canon 5D Mark II, it's still going to be expensive in Beijing as it is in Manhattan or San Francisco or anywhere.
Yes, absolutely. The equipment of that level, as opposed to a bag or a tripod, a camera, a computer, these things all cost the same, because these are high technology items that cost the same to make and sell for the same price with small differences, regardless of where you are, because you're buying that technology that's been put into it. So, yes, exactly. The startup cost for a photographer for that level of equipment is quite high here compared to the rates of pay, which are, of course, still lower mostly than they are in the West.
Have you found that because of that acquisition cost, that analog photography is still much more vibrant and healthier in China than we see it here in the U.S.?
No, actually that's not true, because of course at the amateur level or the point-and-shoot level of digital cameras, they are now much cheaper to use those anywhere in the world than it is to shoot and process film. So you do see on the amateur or on high-end level an absolute explosion of everything from cell phone cameras to point-and-shoot cameras that everyone has here in China. And so actually to do the traditional darkroom work is becoming, as it is in the United States as well, a very specialized kind of high-end thing that does cost a significant amount of money, as it does in the U.S. and in Europe.
Film-wise, do you find that the big giant Kodak has a hold? Do people love Fujifilm because it's Asian and it comes from Japan? Or is there their own lucky brand and they like to buy Chinese-made goods? What do you see for photographers in Asia and in China there? Is there a brand loyalty? It's like a Leica. People love Leicas in Japan, but then they also love Leicas everywhere else. Is there these brand things going on, or is it regional for, say, okay, well, I'm going to buy Lucky Film because it's made in China and I'm Chinese and this is great?
Lucky Film, which I believe was heavily invested at one point by Kodak, unfortunately, in my personal experience, is not great film. I have tried it on several occasions, and unfortunately, I have not found it to be the best film. Obviously, I think maybe someone who spent a little bit more time figuring out a technique to work with it and so on might get much better results than I have. But just anecdotally, at least with some of the other professional photographers I've spoken to, people tend to stay away from Lucky, unfortunately. So black and white photography, Ilford has a very large foothold here for film. The Ilford HP5, and also, it's not sold in the United States, it's called Ilford Pan, but not the Pan F that you're thinking of. It's Ilford Pan 400 and Ilford Pan 200. It seems to be identical to HP5, but it's a bit cheaper. And I think maybe it's just a slightly older formula of it, or perhaps quality control is not so tight, and so they can sell it for a little bit cheaper than they sell the HP5 that they do in the United States and in Europe. For chemistry, I've noticed that Kodak still does have a foothold. You can go and buy D76 and process your film. And for color negative film, which, as we've discussed, is becoming a smaller market but still significant, there's a lot of Fuji film. You can still walk into any one-hour photo lab here. Although these days, I imagine they're making a lot of their money from printing out prints from digital flashcards. But at the same time, they'll still be very happy to sell you what is often Fuji color negative and color slide film.
Wow, very interesting. So, Alan, you've been all over the world shooting. Where do you want to do that you haven't got to do yet? Is there any kind of project you haven't got to shoot? Is there something you've been saving? Is there somewhere you want to go? I mean, I know it clearly shows that you have a passion for photography. If you weren't a photojournalist, you'd still be shooting pictures. You can tell you're into gear. I mean, you're hardcore, you're into black and white. I mean, you can tell you're enjoying yourself. You're having fun.
Absolutely. I want to say that I continue to enjoy my life's work. I think I've been very privileged and very lucky that I have had some success in the past few years. I've covered Iraq and the catastrophe in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, the presidential campaign that elected Barack Obama, the Sichuan earthquake here in China, and the more recent ethnic unrest. I think I can very honestly say that I have a rather full and adventurous life compared to the alternative. So I want to say that there's some places I want to go back to. I'm planning a trip to Afghanistan sometime in the next 6 months. The war there continues and is quite tragic and brutal. I made 3 trips to Afghanistan before, but the last one was some years ago, so I feel time to revisit that. In terms of places that I have not yet been that I would like to go, I think that Africa is on my list. Specifically Southern Africa, South Africa, and countries there. Also Latin and South America, other than some short trips in the Caribbean. I've never explored the Spanish-speaking world. So these are big gaps, I suppose, in my globe-trotting passport. And at some point, I certainly wish to explore them. But I don't want to seem that I do this to have a jet-set life. Quite the contrary, I'm very happy to spend months at a time in Brooklyn. And I think there are plenty of pictures to be made right in New York City, right around the corner from where I live. I think the camera is the best tool we have, in a way, to look at the world. And so I don't think you need to go very far from home, although, of course, it is important and fun and interesting to do so.
Do you ever find that you feel for your safety when you're doing these gigs? I mean, I'm sure going to Iraq and these things weren't really the safest things to do. But then again, I guess it could be the same as going to the Bronx. So, I mean, do you ever feel a danger in what you're doing? Do you feel that because you're a journalist and you probably have correct identification that everything's cool? I mean, how do you feel when you're out shooting?
I want to talk about this a little bit. I want to say a word that over the years, as in any profession, but very particularly in ours, we have lost many of our friends and colleagues in tragic incidents in different places in war. And we mark those losses as, I think, the same way that someone who serves in the military or someone who works on a police force. It's one thing to lose your friend maybe in an accident or to a horrific disease, but it's another when they are in the prime of life doing what they love and they meet a violent end, and that is always very upsetting. So I do want to acknowledge that it is a reality in my job, as it is in many others. But that being said, and I think, again, it's very hard to calculate risk. You can say something's dangerous, but then if nothing happens to you, then it really wasn't that dangerous because you came home. And then if something did happen to you, well, then it's kind of too late to talk about danger because it already happened to you. So I'm not a foolhardy person. I don't consider myself to be particularly courageous. I take what I think to be rational precautions. If there's an area that I feel is too dangerous, I certainly won't go. If there's a situation where it seems to be getting very violent, I will try to be a little bit discreet. But it is true that to be a photojournalist and to cover conflict, there is, I suppose, an aspect to my character and to that of my friends that is, compared to most people, perhaps a little bit thrill-seeking or addicted to adrenaline. Maybe it's a little bit like being a race car driver, where that is part of what drives you. The knowledge that what you're doing is dangerous, but it is also important, and I don't think we should forget that either. And so we sometimes balance the perceived risk with perceived importance of the story. If something seems really dangerous and I'm probably not even going to get a good picture, then I'll pass up. But if something else seems very critical to the story, then I might take an additional risk.
I think that the Western photographer, the Western consumer of media, just generally people in the U.S. have seen James Nockway's documentary, and I'm sure you've seen it too. It's pretty hairy stuff, and the guy's like fearless. And I don't think that you can really portray a photojournalist by watching James's stuff, because James is, I think, a creature all himself.
Well, yeah, I mean, James is a friend of mine, and perhaps this is not the most appropriate story to tell, but there was a time when we actually figured out that we were covering the armies on the opposite front lines from each other in Afghanistan, and so his people were shooting at my people, and my people were shooting at his people, and we were both lucky not to get hit. I mean, Jim sets a standard to which I think even the most intrepid of us have to follow in his footsteps. But I also want to say that I don't think he's particularly foolhardy either. He's taken many risks, of course, but I don't think he's stupid about it. I think he makes a rational calculation, and you simply just try to do the best job you can with that rational calculation, knowing that sometimes the situation will become utterly irrational and that your calculations will be meaningless. But this is something that I think we just have to live with.
Do you think that yourself, James, some of these other guys that are out on the front line here, you guys get to a certain point to where you think everything's rational and cool, and another journalist that works for a nice, docile little paper in Des Moines would think, there's no way in hell I'm going out there, and you guys are like, whoa, let's go, dude.
No, I learned this lesson when I was very young, when I was still in my 20s. We're not soldiers, and we're not policemen, and we're not firefighters. We are witnesses, and we are observers, and we are privileged to be so, and we are invited to be so by the people who we accompany, whether they be soldiers. They are the soldiers and the firefighters and whatnot. So we have to respect their decisions. But in terms of our own decisions, I learned very early on that you must never judge the calculations or the judgments of your colleagues and your friends, because it is different for each of us. And what is my threshold is going to be different from your threshold and the threshold of the next person. And I would never, ever ask anyone to do anything they were not comfortable with. I think that is there's simply a level of respect that you have to have. It is a little bit more difficult sometimes when you have to hire a translator, or as we call them, fixers, people who are our guides, basically, who have local knowledge that we don't, who speak the language when we don't. And sometimes it's very difficult to ask somebody to accompany you, knowing that you're probably going to be, even if you say that you're not, you're implicitly asking them to share the same risks that you are. And this is sometimes a very difficult and sensitive thing to do. And I have tried very hard, whenever I've been in that situation, to be utterly forthright that I am not asking anyone to do anything that they're not comfortable with.
Yeah, I think that's great advice, and I just know that typically if you're in a situation where you're comfortable with, you would think that, okay, I think it's safe to go out, but I guess maybe someone that would not typically be in that situation would be utterly scared out of their gourd, and you guys are so seasoned and have been in this, it's like, oh, you want me to go shoot a story over here in Iraq or Afghanistan? Okay, where's the plane ticket? Let's go. And most people would be like, dude, I'm not going there, no way.
Well, you just characterized Jim Nockway as being fearless. And I think to some degree that's true, but I don't think it's true for most of us. I get as afraid as the next person when confronted with something that seems dangerous. I'm not immune from fear. I think you have to be very honest about your own fear in this. I will say this, though. I think having done all the things that I've done has helped me come to terms with that, to be able to understand my own limits better, as you said, perhaps better than a person who doesn't do this. But I watched the way people fly small airplanes, or bungee jumpers jump off bridges just for fun. I would never do that. Maybe I feel the same way about things that for other people seem utterly normal, if a little bit fun or something. Like riding that cyclone roller coaster in Coney Island in New York was far more frightening in my experience than any war I've been in. And I know that sounds utterly ridiculous and farcical, but it's utterly true. I remember the first time I rode that roller coaster, my heart almost popped out of my chest. So I think we all have our different limits, and experience does breed a level of familiarity. The truth is that most people are not very comfortable in the presence of a lot of guns or a lot of people with weapons and things like this. I've become very used to that. I'm with someone with a gun, unless he has a specific reason to want to do harm to you, he's just doing his job too. And if you understand that and try to, even by sharing a cigarette or a cup of coffee or even just a hello, how are you, if you can establish some common ground with people, even if they don't know who you are and don't trust you and certainly don't really want you to be there, they're probably not going to wish you any actual harm. And so it's street smarts, the kind of thing you learn if you grow up in the projects or if you grow up working in the mines or something like that. For journalists and for photographers, it's something that we have to learn as we basically invite ourselves into the lives of perfect strangers who don't really know who we are, and we're asking them to allow us to photograph and to listen to their stories and to know everything about them.
Well, I think so, and I think a lot of people think you're a hero to start with just because of your enlightenment with film and how you still help promote analog photography. And I'm sure people think that you're completely whacked because what are you doing here shooting film? And Alan's out in the back souping something in the back of a rental car or in a bathroom at a restaurant to try to get something done. And most of these guys are going to look at you and go, well, you're crazy anyway. So I think in the eyes of true diehard traditional photographers, you're a hero to start with already, buddy.
Well, like I said, I think they're pretty crazy to be sitting there agonizing over the digital noise of their digital file while they're trying to fix in Photoshop. I think that there is enough of a market, however niche it is, and is becoming for analog photography, that it will survive. I've noticed that Ilford for a while could not keep film in stock. Of course, they make a lot less of it than they used to, but what little they were making, they were selling out. So we've hopefully stabilized at a level where, of course, it's not going to be mass market that it once was, where everybody shoots film. But I think amongst artists and professionals and hobbyists and people just with a love of the craft and a love to experiment, or people who just like a particular aesthetic effect, that it's going to survive. I'm fairly confident of that based on the last couple of years. We had a few years where it was dying each year, and we thought that it might not exist at all in a few years. And even this year, Kodak has finally discontinued Kodachrome. It's the first color film ever, and of course that's symbolically a rather sad moment. But I think even as certain things get discontinued, the other things will continue to be made, and people will continue to use them and enjoy them and love what they can do with them.
Well, I think, Alan, when they see your work and what you're doing, how you have to go through this extra difficulty to shoot analog product out in the field like you're doing, it just gives people the push and the drive forward to say, I am going to keep shooting this on film, and it does have a certain look, and it is very cool. I think it's great work you're doing.
Thank you. I certainly hope so. But like I said, there are also times that my Leicas are fully mechanical cameras. They do not need batteries, and so I've never had a battery die and forget to charge your battery, and you're stuck with a digital camera. I've never had a flash card become corrupt. I mean, okay, sure, maybe I've opened the camera before I rewound the film and lost a few frames. Even if you lose an entire roll of film, you lose 36 frames. If you lose a flash card, you're losing 200 or 300 these days. So I think film still has a lot of advantages beyond just the aesthetic. I think even practically working in the field, the good cameras like the Leicas are very reliable machines, and they've served me well over the years. I know that I can depend on my equipment the way that I'm not so sure with the newer digital cameras and with the computers. As I said, I actually travel with two computers because I've been in situations where I've gotten a virus or had my hard drive have a problem, and then you're really stuck. Whereas with the Leica, you pretty much know that unless you actually pound a rock on it or something like that, that it's pretty much going to work for you no matter what.
Yeah, this is great stuff. I really do appreciate taking time out of your trip there in Beijing. We definitely would like to talk to you some more, Alan, when you get back to the States. When you can have some more relaxed time, we could chat more about what you're doing, your photojournalistic adventures, and all this great work you're doing. I really do appreciate the time to speak to us today, to our listeners, and just give us an insight about Alan Chin and what you're up to and all this beautiful work you're doing, buddy.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Well, there you go. Alan Chin, what a lot of great stories, a lot of cool stuff going on with Alan. Amazing. He's in China right now taking photographs on film, souping stuff in the hotel, in his apartment, wherever he can, the back of a car, and just great to see him doing all this beautiful black and white photography, color, and all this documentary and photojournalistic work. It's just really great stuff. The Inside Analog Photography radio program is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com, and of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group over at www.apug.org, our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Shipper, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.